Nothing undermines order and authority more than rules that are not or cannot be enforced. And I think we have an educational system which is filled with rules, both curriculum rules and behavioral rules, that either are not implemented and enforced or that literally cannot be enforced or implemented.
Welcome back to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12. I'm your host, Steve, and this is episode 47. Today I'm talking education with Ron Walker. Ron is the president of Walker Educational Consulting. He has been an educational consultant since 1992, during which time he's worked with over 500 schools and school systems. He now also operates the Sage Academy in Gainesville, Georgia, which is focused on the needs of high-risk students. Ron has been in education for over 39 years, and let me tell you something, he is not afraid to speak his mind. Ron will make you think and challenge you to look deeper into what is typical in education. Today you'll hear us talk about everything from teaching as an art form to his work with kids and attention deficit disorders. We also take a look at issues of classroom management, instructional strategies that can be implemented tomorrow, and his thoughts about small group teaching, which may be just a bit controversial. I challenge you to listen closely and digest what Ron has to say. Then ask yourself, what can I change that I do in my classroom or school to better serve the kids? Enjoy.
They're not here for us. We're here for them. That's what it's about. Kids.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is all about assisting classroom teachers and school administrators to overcome the many walls or barriers that kids face. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is focused on helping you help kids achieve their dreams. As a note, I hope that you will stop by Stitcher or iTunes and leave me a star rating and a comment. That helps the show get noticed by more people. Thanks for listening and joining me week after week.
Welcome to the Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 podcast, bringing you ideas and resources for K-12 classrooms, schools, and school districts. Hosted by Steve Mileto. And now, here's Steve with this week's show.
Hey, Steve here again with Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, and today I'm talking with Ron Walker. He is the president of Walker Educational Consulting and the educational director for the National Physicians Consortium in Attention Disorders. Ron's career has taken him from Kentucky to Georgia in various capacities of working with children and education. He has been an active consultant for nearly 500 schools and school districts since 1992. His consulting work includes workshops, school evaluations, implementation of school improvement plans, and demonstration teaching. He now has opened a small private school called the Sage Academy in Gainesville, Georgia. The Sage Academy uses a blended model for high-risk students who are trying to achieve high school diplomas. Say hi to everybody, Ron.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
Well, thanks again, Ron, for joining me. And what I'd like to do first is just ask you this. You've been in education for over 39 years. Why did you become a teacher?
Originally, I became a teacher because I had a mentor who told me, she was actually a nun, who told me that God had wanted me to be a teacher. That sounds a little crazy now, but I had just finished my undergraduate education and was taking a year off before I went back to what I thought was going to be law school, or perhaps psych grad school, and she offered me a job at her school in Louisville, Kentucky. So then I never left.
Very nice. Excellent. Tell us a little bit about that, because that school that you started in there. Can you tell us just a little bit about what it
was? Well, I started, my first teaching experience was at the DePaul School, which it continues to be one of the nation's leading schools for dyslexic children. In fact, was recently named one of the top 20 private schools, special education private schools in the United States. And I worked there for 2 years, then went back to graduate school in developmental psychology. Then I went back to DePaul and spent 5 years running both their day and their residential programs.
Excellent. Thank you for talking about that. So I wanted to make sure I pulled that out, because where I wanted to go next is just to ask you this. What would you say is your primary focus in education? You know, what is it that you're seeking to do as you continued through your 39 years?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question. I increasingly, as I've gotten older, I have returned to my focus on the individual child and the individual school. I spent a long time as a consultant talking to large crowds and probably making small changes to a lot of people at a time. But now I'm really more focused on that. I go in and work with kids every single day, and I'm more and more focused on the idea that real empowerment as an educator comes from the ability to change the life of a single child who otherwise will go in some direction that doesn't benefit them or our culture.
Nice. I appreciate that, because that seems to kind of come out clear in some of your bio and different things that I know about what you do, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. Before we go into any more detail there, do you have a hero whose philosophy or saying or quotation that helps guide you in your daily routines and life overall? Do you have something that's kind of like that sort of philosophy that keeps you going that direction? Or
no, I really had not. That's a really interesting question. I have a favorite quotation that guides me in my implementation in education, but it's not a personal philosophy. My philosophy is really kind of a libertarian Christian approach. I'm a lifelong Episcopalian and spent many years in youth ministry in the Episcopal Church. But my favorite quotation about education actually comes from Albert Einstein, which he wrote when he was in his 50s. And the quotation says, "Nothing undermines order and authority more than rules that are not or cannot be enforced." And I think we have an educational system which is filled with rules, both curriculum rules and behavioral rules, that either are not implemented and enforced, or that literally cannot be enforced or implemented. So in designing the new school that I've opened, my entire focus has been around the idea of, let's minimize the things that we require so that we maximize the production that we get out of our school day.
Nice. Do you know where he was going with that?
Yeah, I do. The context of that is that he was writing a letter protesting the treatment of the scientists at Los Alamos, where the government had put in all kinds of what he viewed as petty restrictions on the scientists and their communication. He was actually protesting to President Roosevelt that that it was undermining the work ethic and the morale of people to have all these rules that could not actually be implemented. And it was only later, after Roosevelt's death, that someone started going through letters that they uncovered this quotation in the context of it. But it's been my experience, and I'm working with a school tomorrow, that we're really implementing exactly that same policy, which is, it's a school where the rule structure has been written but not enforced. And over a long period of time, a decade or more, increasingly, there is disrespect from both the staff, the students, and the parents of the school for the driving mission of what the school is about. And we're trying to simplify those structures. And I think that, teachers understand this more than anyone else, because in my 39 years in education, when I started teaching, you went in and taught, and people watched you, and you were accountable for whether you did a good job or not. And now there are a million standards and a million forms and, a bureaucracy laden upon bureaucracy. So nobody is more familiar with the idea of unnecessary rule structures than teachers, I think.
Appreciate you talking about that, because you're so right about how different and how constrained, the classroom is now, different from...
Yeah, and it hasn't helped. That's the critical part of that, is that the movement, I'm all for the movement for accountability, but when we move for accountability by passing rules rather than making true change, we actually worsen the product. And I don't care what anyone says, there are not, in fact, fewer children who are academically floundering than there were a decade ago. It is not correct that we are leaving no children behind. In fact, we are leaving more behind than we were a decade ago, and it's just not possible to undermine the truth with the data that's out there.
I think it's an interesting thing, kind of going with what you're talking about, that part of what you see is that just kind of, whether you want to talk about stress or whether you want to talk about that kids are put under to do well on standardized tests, especially kids who need a little bit longer to think and respond to some questions, or who would like at least a little bit longer to think about questions.
Right.
To even concepts that I've had when I've worked with kids on forums where they met with me when I was a principal, they would talk about how they would say things, and this is not me making this up. These are kids telling me this, when I'd ask them, tell me about things that we could do better in the school. And when you start getting this message, well, the teachers need more time because they seem to be so pushed to get us to the end so we can take the test that they really don't have time to go in depth and detail in classroom activities.
And I think wise students perceive exactly what teachers see. And the live course that I'm teaching this year is a world history course. And the world history textbook, which I probably won't mention here by name, but it has 36 chapters and is 974 pages long. And it is not reasonably possible to cover the actual material at that rate. Now, fortunately, since I am under no constrictions, I teach at the rate that I think children are actually going to learn, so that we learn what material we can cover that I deem important, but we really learn it. And I think it has an impact on their life. But if you're in a public school, you are going to be on a pacing guide that says, it's Tuesday, you'll be here, and next Tuesday you will give this test, and next Thursday you will do this. And that, we are gaining nothing in education by doing it that way. We are losing an enormous amount by doing it that way.
So since you've kind of gone that direction, in the school setting, what do you think the greatest challenge is that a teacher faces right now in this world that we're in?
Maintaining a sense of vocation. I mean, traveling as broadly as I have and listening to as many different teachers in as many different settings, private, public, rich, poor, from the most privileged to really heart of inner city, I think the challenge is the same. It's maintaining a sense of passion and energy in the face of the perception that teaching is no longer valued as a profession, and that teachers are treated like as if they were infants rather than as if they were professionals.
Gotcha. In working with teachers and principals now, you get that feeling quite a bit that they feel like they're treated just like you just described.
We've been fanalized to teachers. We believe that it is necessary to tell them what they are going to do each and every day and every moment of that period. But if you actually work with students, it's an art form, and what you need to do has to be often determined on the fly and in the circumstances of the moment and based on what the student says and what piece of information they try to hang on and what fires them up. And I just think to a huge extent we have taken that out of teaching, and I don't think that anybody is being served by the fact that we've removed that.
Let's use that as a kind of a strange sort of segue, but a segue into a big part of your background deals with there's something there about working with attention disorders. I was wondering if you could kind of talk about that just a little bit.
Well, it's been a long time. Back in 1992, I joined Edna Copeland, who was one of the founders of CHAD, Children with Attention Deficit Disorders. When I came back to Louisville and moved for personal reasons back to Atlanta and to aging parents, I took over as her educational director. So that was the field of, that was the hot era of attention disorders, of ADHD. And so I became, gave a lot of trainings in it, read all the literature, joined all the scientific groups that were involved in that. And I am persuaded that there is a neurologic condition, which is rightfully labeled attention deficit disorders. But the line between the change in our culture and the neurologic condition is so blurred that it is impossible to correctly diagnose whether we are watching cultural and environmental issues or neurologic issues, because there's no standing neurologic definition of the disorder. That is, you cannot administer, an fMRI or some kind of a brain tool that you can say, look at and say, this is ADHD and this is normal. And we are not at that level of science, and I'm not sure that actually that's an attainable level of science. I'm not sure that conceptually that's an accurate way to view it. But the whole culture has attention disorders. I mean,
right.
We live in the fleeting time where everything lasts and for just moments. It's a Snapchat generation. And that kind of personifies that Instagram, Snapchat, that metaphor for understanding the new generation of students, I think that's the heart of the understanding, that you have their attention, and it's intense attention, but you have it very briefly, and you have it only if it's of high interest value.
I appreciate you sharing that, because you see quite a bit of what you're talking about, the idea that how difficult it is to tell what what's the cultural and the coming from the world that the kids live in to what might actually be neurological. So,
in every major city in Georgia or in the United States for that matter, there are physicians who, if you go there, you come out with a diagnosis of attention deficit disorders, and that they're plainly not doing any kind of differential diagnosis on that issue. And it's not to say that the kids don't have attention problems, but I'm not persuaded that we're accurately distinguishing between the problems of the culture and the problems that might be specific to an individual's brain.
Gotcha. Let's go from there. Let's go back to, I want to go back to your consultant world. And I want to talk about, as a consultant for school systems and schools, what issues are you asked most often to assist with?
Well, I had actually kind of gone into a little bit of, I don't want to say semi-retirement, but at one time I was up around traveling like nearly 200 days a year, and now I try to travel only 2 or 3 days a month. So I'm pretty selective in the things that I try to do now, and I really try to focus on one of two things, is either to give trainings which are specific to classroom issues. For instance, I do a training on multisensory math and applications for basic math skills. So it's very specific, with strategies that are designed to be implemented the next day. It's not programmatic in any sense. It's do this, try this. Or there are school improvement programs where I work over the long term, usually more than a year at a time, and 3, 4, 5 days or 8 days during that year, where you're going in and trying to uncover what are the critical variables that have this school in trouble, and what is it that we can do that will impact those things. And so those are kind of the two areas that I'm focused on, either workshops which are very hands-on and not theoretical in nature, but let's try this tomorrow. I've seen this work. Try this with your kids. If you've got kids that are struggling doing this, do this, so that teachers have an immediate toolkit to go back and try. Or the longer-term issue of the systemic issue, because there are so many schools in America that, they have years of failure, really, that they're trying to overcome.
Right. I like what you're talking about, because the immediate toolkit is so necessary. It's so much. In presentations that I do, I just did one the other day, and one of the things I talk about, one of the things that drives me nuts is that there'll be works that come out where, not trying to attack their research, I'm not trying to attack their the quality of their research, but I am going to attack the fact that it's not really usable for a teacher. Because it'll come out where you wonder if the people are just trying to coin a phrase or something, and so they're focused on naming things with these particular names, and you'd have to spend probably a year reading it and probably have somebody interpret all the words that they're using. In order to, and so there, you can't put it in place the next day, like what you're talking about.
Everything in education now, of course, is research-based, and I always do a little thing in workshops that you said. How many of you have been to a workshop where the presenter told you that this information was research-based, but your impression was not in a million years would that happen like that in my classroom? It's just not true. And I think we're just posting a huge hoax in American education, especially in the public educational system, of going for ideas that are not sound in that regard.
I appreciate what you're saying there, because that's something that, it is amazing to me when I listen, having been in different types of schools, one of the commonalities is that, the teachers do not have time to spend having somebody's research all torn apart and broken down for them, and then trying to figure out how to implement it. They need something they can take, learn how to use it
tomorrow,
and put it in place tomorrow. Exactly.
Right. And if it works, you keep it. And if it doesn't work, you discard it and keep on looking for the next idea. That just basic common sense notion of how to teach, I think, has been lost.
That's unfortunate because, you know, it's kind of, there's a, you know, you have to have that bag of tricks that you go back to, which, and
right.
I shouldn't call it bag of tricks, I guess, but that's what it is. Your strategy when something doesn't work, now let's try something else. And so actually having time to pay attention to the fact that it's not working, I think is an important aspect of what you're talking about.
Well, I think most of the time, at least in public education, whether it's working or not, it doesn't make a difference. Teachers are required to do such and so.
Gotcha.
And we use evaluation systems that require them to do such and so without any real regard for whether it's working or not. We measure against a tool which is not classroom success. It's an arbitrary standard. I mean, you know, we have evaluation tools which vary widely from state to state, but one that, I mean, it just kills me in the research is that there's a very strong research out there that shows that the loudest and most interactive adolescent classrooms actually are producing the highest academic achievement. That if you look at the highest achieving classrooms, they're actually very active, and there's a lot of talking, and kids are not sitting there and, you know, gradually raising their hands.
What I was going to ask you next was this. What advice or constructive criticism, you know, when you're working with the schools and so forth, what advice or constructive criticism did you find yourself giving again and again? What kind of areas did it seem like it seemed to be constant?
More than any other single area, I think it's training teachers what I would call basic classroom management. But in common sense, just everyday terms, it means I think we get a lot of teachers who do not know how to produce respect for authority, cannot get kids to sit down and be quiet and follow instructions. And so more than any other single thing, I've been asked, how do I train my teachers who do not have personal authority to command respect in the classroom and get kids to do what they tell them to do? And we do essentially no training of that process in education courses, which that's my experience. We do very little training of that.
Yeah, that's something that I'm finding my own little niche for here as well. It's I've started a classroom management class where they can sign up for or they can get assigned to. And then once we talk about certain specific aspects and get them talking about what they struggle with or where they need assistance, then I come visit them in their classroom and give them some feedback and try and give them some coaching advice from there. And it's I'm right on that boat with you. I see what you're I know exactly what you're talking about.
Well, when I and on that, you know, to kind of elaborate on that topic, I think the single most critical thing that we know from the research, and which is absolutely certainly true in real life experience, is the movement of the teacher in the classroom is the single most important determinant of classroom behavior, which is based on the proximity principle. And proximity principle rules were first written into educational textbooks in the 1920s as part of the Dewey movement. And the concept that the teacher needs to be in constant movement in the classroom, and that modern children pay better attention to a moving target than a stationary target, and that if you are standing immediately next to those children, they won't misbehave, but if you're 40 feet away from them paying attention to someone else, they will.
Yeah.
That fundamental concept is not taught. And, I mean, things as simple as wearing a step-counting device are often my advice to principals for staffs that are having that kind of a problem. That we need, you know, to get a baseline measure of how many steps the teacher is taking during whatever period of the day it is that they're having a problem, get just a baseline count of average steps per minute, and then set a goal which is higher than that. Because your teachers who have the biggest problems in the classroom, a lot of them truly are not competent, and a good sizable number of them are regretfully lazy. And you have to do something which you can actually measure and see. And I think a lot of these teachers have given up on being successful, and if they get any taste of success in the classroom, it refires them up, and a lot of their motivation and energy for education returns.
You're right on the money with that. I know that if you can figure out how to help them get some of that success, it's amazing what it for their focus and their excitement for why they're there.
Which is exactly the same in students. So, I mean, it's
right.
Just applying the same lesson that we are to our students.
So with when we talk about instruction, let's shift to instruction for a minute. Are there any particular instructional strategies that you believe every teacher should be using or attempting to use?
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard to say when you're talking cross disciplines.
Right.
But,
okay, unfair question. Sorry, but
I have a general kind of an answer for that.
Okay.
Which is, I believe that we have de-emphasized the ability to provide quality group direct instruction. And we have grossly overemphasized individualizing our educational program and working with small groups and facilitating students doing their own learning. It's not that I don't think those are wonderful concepts, but I think we've just gone, just way past the common sense middle on those issues right there. Such that there are lots of educational theorists and educational programs that are basically telling beginning teachers that whole group direct instruction is bad.
Right.
And that's not the way you need to teach the classroom. Well, unfortunately, that is just completely incorrect. If we look back in our own educational careers, I think the vast majority of us, if we talked about a teacher from whom we had learned a great deal or had made an important difference in our life, they were somebody that could stand in front of a room of 20 or 30 or 35 people and talk and be interesting and communicate information, and people shut up and listen to them.
Right.
And that skill is gone. I mean, the emphasis on training that skill has gone.
Well, I think a big part of that is that, like you were saying, I mean, it became bad. It became the thing that people say, this is bad. And so instead of talking about how you do it correctly or how you use it, and instead it just becomes bad, and we can't mention that word, almost like we're reading Harry Potter and it's he who cannot, who shall not be named type thing. And
that's a very apt metaphor for it. It becomes dogma. And once it becomes dogma in American education, it's not possible to find a common sense middle ground. It was certainly true that there was a time in American public education when we grossly overemphasized whole group direct instruction.
Right.
But there is a middle ground on this curve, which is the correct implementation of both individualizing your instruction and being able to command a group. And I think we've just, the metaphor that I use is that our education in America, much more so than true in European or Asian models, is a pendulum swing, such that we go all the way in one direction and way too far. And then when we readjust, the pendulum comes flying back the other direction and goes way too far the other direction, and we can't ever get the thing to stop in the middle. And that was true in behavior management principles, and that's the difference between, like, the old math and the new math, and between rigorous phonetic instruction and whole language emphasis. We never could see the truth of both sides and get to a common sense middle.
It's amazing that happens. I don't understand it, but I just think it's just too easy for, when I was talking to a group of primarily principals the other day, and one of the things I said is that we find ourselves under pressure to make major changes in what we're, in the worlds of our schools. And so that makes us fall, not quite victims, but it makes us easy prey for someone trying to sell us something that is the latest, greatest thing that's going to fix everything.
That's the basic plot line story of American education since World War II. It's the latest, greatest thing. And we fall for it again and again. And what I have seen in 39 years now is that no sooner does a school district go out and spend tens of thousands dollars implementing some new language program and spend thousands of dollars on consultants who come in and train all that, and and it's all the thing that we're going to emphasize and use all our staff development time and money on it, and then 5 years later they decide that that wasn't the thing, and then they implement yet a new program. And teachers are just, I think the best teachers, what they do is they listen to it all, they go with the flow as much as they have to, but they find their own central ground, because they know that things are going to come and go. And how many times have you heard a teacher say, this too will pass?
Right, right. Many times they're talking about their principal.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. Stumble through that one.
Yeah, that's actually fairly interesting. I don't know if you saw that article in Educator about, I don't know, 6 or 8 months ago now, that said that the average tenure had dropped from 14 years of a principal to 4.5 years since 1970.
Wow, I did not see that article.
So we've cut the average tenure of a principal at a single spot has been cut to a third of what it was in 1970, and that's a bad, bad thing. I mean, it's certainly true that there were principals that had long outlived their usefulness at a site, but it's also true that now what happens is that if you are on the educational ladder to success, you know how that thing goes. You know, you are a classroom teacher, you get a master's degree, you get an ed-eds degree, you become an assistant principal, you get a little more training, you go to some workshops, somebody likes you, you become a principal of a small school, somebody, you know, that we see that process, and it has become like a career climbing ladder rather than thinking, I'm in a place that feels like home to me.
Well, that's you're right, and I think another part of that also, I think there's another step to it, which is then the pressure's now to make change where, you know, it's not like dealing with Henry Ford and his Model T's by tightening a bolt or something and you fix the rim on the car and all the kids are better suddenly by fixing that little bolt. If it's not happening, if they're not getting not getting
better quickly.
Right, better quickly. There you go. If they're not getting better quickly, then let's just throw out the principal and let's get a new one. And I think that it tends to be some of the what's happening there.
I don't know whether you've discussed this in your workshops with anyone else, but I mean, no one wants to acknowledge the elephant in the room, but cheating is rampant in the American public educational system. I mean, people want to deny that all that they want to, but there is just enormous evidence that people make gains that are statistically not reasonably possible given the populations that they have. That variables are being manipulated which go outside the classroom. And I just, you know, when you see schools that, you know, they raise 2 grade levels, their average reading level has gone up, or they went from where 14% of their group passed to where 71% of them passed the next year. Either we've cheated on the testing or, and has been true in many states, including the state of Georgia, we manipulate how hard the test is so that when everybody is failing the test and we get bad press about it, we simply make the test easier, which artificially raises our pass rates. And, you know, there have been more than one example in our own state of where that has been the process of how we went about it in the end-of-course testing. So, you know, we've seen when the end-of-course testing produced failure rates that were in the 30 or 40%, we would try for a year or two to dramatically reduce that number. A few schools dramatically reduced the number, and they did it by manipulating the variable. At least that's what I believe. And when we couldn't manipulate the variable enough, the test itself became substantially easier.
Well, and my favorite example of what you're talking about is there's states who have done this as well as school systems. But, you know, if you want to make your SAT scores look good, you only give the number for reporting it to certain kids and not to
exactly all
of them. So
that's exactly right. And you, you know, you pick a subgroup or you match states that 80% of kids are taking them versus states that 12% of them are taking it. I mean, you know, it's easy to lie with statistics, but the explanation, the attention span is so short in American culture that the explanation of why something is a lie takes longer than the attention span of the people who have been lied to.
I like that. That's sad.
But I really believe that is the case, so that you are able to just successively go from one lie to another, you know, with your claims of what is and is not working, because it takes too long to stop and actually look at the process. And as I think someone from your research, that is the issue that I believe is going on with the whole individualized versus small group versus direct instruction model, that there's basically a lie that the data does not support, but you can't, to explain why it's not true, you need a workshop and an explanation of educational principles. And by that time, the vast majority of people have dozed off or gone on to their...
moved on.
Changed channels. Right. Right. Changed channels on you.
Yeah, I like that. And you beat me to the to that question, because I was going to say that when you talk to people who've been to anywhere you've given a keynote or something, or talked about small group, that you have a little different take on it. And that's usually what they say. And so I was going to ask you what that different take is on.
Well, it again goes back to the idea of attention span and proximity as a primary behavioral control device. I think all of that research kind of fits together, which is small group instruction works only if your students who are not in the small group are capable of independent, well-behaved instruction without an adult oversight. So it's all based on this premise. So if I'm going to hold reading groups in my class, or I'm going to hold math groups in my class, or, you know, or I'm going to hold centers in my class where I work with one center and then they go to four other centers on their own, that is all based on the basic premise that my students are capable of independently learning and behaving appropriately without direct adult supervision. And there are places where that is in fact true.
Right.
And there are teachers that can in fact produce that effect. But the vast majority of children in America, in the vast majority of public schools in America, if you leave 18 children unattended for any length of time without a teacher within 6 or 8 or 10 feet of them, depending on the age of the child, and the teacher is paying attention to other students, they will either stop learning or misbehave or both. And if you're in high schools, they do bad things. You know, they are on their phones continuously, and they, you know, I don't care about cell phone communication. I don't fight any battles over that with the kids that are at Sage Academy.
Right.
They can have their cell phones out in absolute plain view, and as long as they are working, I don't care whether they're texting. It doesn't make any difference to me as long as they're learning, because that's the future of the way that the culture is going. What amazes me is how many text messages and pictures and stuff they are receiving from their friends who are in public schools where cell phones are banned.
Right. It's kind of like
there's a continuous flow coming while this student is sitting in chemistry class or while they're in English class.
Right.
I mean, the other day I had a kid who had received a they were over there laughing, and it was their lunch. I said, "What are you laughing at?" He said, "You won't believe this video." They said, "Man, somebody is video and editing a video and putting captions on the video during a high school instructional period."
Oh, my gosh.
And no one has enough oversight to even realize that that is going on. Well, that's the problem with small group instruction, or in a high school classroom when the teacher sits at their desk and is on a computer, and then kids are supposed to be, you know, answering those 7 questions that are at the end of the chapter. That is just not an effective educational model for modern American children.
Gotcha. I appreciate you talking about that. I do have to say, I think it's kind of like outlawing gum in schools, what you're talking about, that with the phones. If you outlaw the phones, you have to really wonder if you've made that, or if they're just very good at still texting while they're in their pockets.
Yeah, well, I mean, that goes back to the Einstein quote that I've talked about. And I don't want to pat my back excessively, although I kind of like to do that, but I've been saying this for 15 years now, or maybe close to 2 decades, from the dawn of the cell phone age when your average adolescent had one. This is an absolutely pointless battle that we are going to lose. The battle is about learning.
Right.
The battle is about appropriate behavior, about appropriate language, about appropriate pictures, about learning algebra. I mean, that's the battle that I'm fighting. And so I'm going to measure my success by, does my student learn binomial factoring? Do they behave appropriately toward their peers and toward me as an adult? And I'm not going to worry about whether they, because, you know, it's astonishing how efficient kids are today at doing multiple things at the same time.
Right.
And adults do that and then turn around and try to outlaw students doing it.
Of course. As we're kind of, I got a couple questions I'd like to ask you that are that are not in this venue. And so let's just, as we're getting close to finishing here, let me ask you this, Ron. If you had a chance to talk to 100 brand new teachers, they haven't set foot in their classroom yet, they've been hired by school systems, what advice would you give them about teaching? What would be that one or two, those one or two takeaways that you would want them to hear before they got in that classroom?
Yeah, the first thing I do every once in a while, I used to when I was traveling all the time, get that opportunity a lot and have worked in a lot of new teacher, like, you know, when Henry County was training 200 new teachers every year and I was working every year. My first piece of advice is find an old, respected teacher that's been there several decades and is still happy. And do everything that they say to do. Eat lunch with them as you can. Socialize with them if you can. Take your problems to them. Call them at home. Attach yourself to somebody who's done it for several decades, who is respected as a person, and who still looks happy. Because they know something that you need to know. And that, I think, is the first and most fundamental piece of advice. And my second piece of advice, and the one that we're just missing completely, I think, in education courses, is you must get children to like you and respect you at the same time. But if they do not like you, they will no longer learn for you. Yeah. And in the generation that I came from, that wasn't true.
Right.
You learned regardless of whether you did or did not like the teacher. But the level of personal relationship that is required to motivate students has changed completely. If you are a person that respects them and interacts with them the proper way, I can go into very high-risk classrooms where kids have all kinds of behavior problems and, you know, all kinds of terrible things have been reported about the classroom, and you can still get kids to talk appropriately to you and be reasonable human beings and listen and learn. But it's all based at the emotional level, not at the cognitive level. And I think we're underemphasizing that in training this generation of teachers. And so many young teachers have flipped to the other side, and that's why we have so many issues of teachers that have crossed the boundaries and do illegal activities with young people and among adolescents, because they found out that the relationship is everything, but they haven't figured out how to get that and also get the respect of adulthood.
Right. That's so on the money. I appreciate you sharing that advice. With that, if you could go back in time, you know, time travel, let's just send you back in time, and you had the chance to change one thing in the development and training of teachers that was way back when, is there something that you would stop them from doing?
Yeah, I would have changed the whole nature of student teaching or practice teaching or whatever it is that we want to call it, and I would have made it the prerequisite course for all education courses. It still should be done that way. I mean, that's where I would go back. I would require everybody that thinks that they want to be a teacher to spend a semester in real classrooms interacting under teachers who are reasonably successful and who have done it for a long time before they can take any other education course.
Nice. I like that idea.
Because there's so many teachers that they invest 3 years and then they actually get out there in classrooms and they're like, oh my God, this is not what
You're right.
People that are like that, they're like, this was not what I was expecting it was going to be like.
And we
should solve it by going the other direction.
Nice. I like that. You're right on the money. I mean, so many times you see that. I mean, in my own experience, you get in there and I was excited by the challenge of trying to figure out how to get the kids to work with me. But, you know, there's some of them, they go out there and they go, oh my gosh, they don't just work for you.
Right.
You're like, yeah. Dude, what do you think, man? My favorite one is to tell people, to tell young people is please remember this, that when you get in the classroom, you're old. All right. Because, no matter how much you want to say, hey, I'm like you, I'm not too far removed from high school and all this sort of stuff, they don't care. That's not going to help you win that battle. What you got to do is you got to figure out how to develop that respect you're talking about before. And it doesn't come from, you know, being Attila the Hun and
right. It does not.
Lopping off heads. And it also doesn't come the other way by giving them candy, you know? So, but I like that. Well, let me ask this last question, and I like to ask my guests the following. If you thought back to when you were in school as a student, K through 12, was there a teacher you wish you could thank? And if so, who was it and why?
Yeah, there's more than one. I benefited. I'm a K-12 graduate of Georgia Military Academy and Woodward Academy on the south side of Atlanta. I was really blessed with a fabulous education, and there's more than one. But the one that I tell the most stories on was a man named Abe Ferguson. He was called the Major, although he could not have been less military. And he taught me in Latin and French. I had him for five consecutive years in honors foreign language. And he violated essentially every rule of good teaching and was eccentric beyond any reasonable measure. But the joy that he felt in teaching and the humor that he brought to the classroom and the amount of energy that he brought to the level of teaching just, I did not just learn the subjects, but I just had a profound love for the man. And I was fortunate enough that when I was a young teacher and went back as a teacher and then an administrator at Woodward Academy, I had a chance to know him, certainly not as a peer, but from when we were both on the educator side of that platform. And I wish that I had, he was a hard man to have approached like that, but I really regret that I never tried to just sit down with him with a cup of tea, of Earl Grey tea, which is what he drank, and tell him how much he meant.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing. Well, Ron, I greatly appreciate you talking with me today and sharing your thoughts about education. And before we go, is there any place on the web or out there where if somebody wanted to contact you, find out more information, that it would be easy to do that?
Well, the best place is just ronwalker62@AOL.com. It's the easiest way to get on to me, ronwalker62@AOL.com, or to go through Sage Academy on the Facebook page, because we're certainly up and going at the technologic level for Facebook. So Sage Academy in Gainesville is where I am at the current time, and you can see pictures of me and the kids in action, and I just posted a couple yesterday. So we are up to date to see what it is I'm doing in education right now.
Well, excellent. And I've been there, and it's a nice Facebook page, and I appreciate it. Ron, thank you so very much for all your time. I greatly appreciate it, and I wish you the best. Have a great rest of the week.
Hope to see you soon. Bye.
Take care now.
Hello, listeners. We want to remind everyone to check out all of our digital content at teachinglearningleadingk12.com. That's teachinglearningleadingk12.com. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Just search Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 in the iTunes Store. Check back often for updates and new material.
Hang tight, everyone. I'm going to let go of the wall.
You have been listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, recorded in Eastman, Georgia, at the Heart of Georgia Precinct.